This is what you need to know about today. The war is back on. The U.S. has hit four sites inside Iran, and Iran has fired back at U.S. military installations. The Houthis in Yemen are now engaged. So is Israel. It's called re-escalation, and we're going to break it down for you right here on The Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and once again, I'm forced to say it's back on. The United States and Israel's war on Iran has re-escalated. And seemingly in a pretty big way. Overnight, the U.S. bombed Iran for four straight hours. They targeted some 20 different locations in the country. Iran responded by hitting U.S. targets as well, bases, military installations. They hit Jordan, they hit Bahrain, and they hit Kuwait, right? Let me try and bring you the most current timeline. I know things are changing, and it's only been going on in the last 24 hours. First, the report came in, which you may remember a couple days ago, of a U.S. military Apache helicopter that was down in the Strait of Hormuz. Now, that seems to be what set this whole thing into action, right? There's no doubt that the chopper was down somehow, but there's not a real sense of clarity about this, as far as I can tell. And by the way, thankfully for the crew, they were able to eject and they were rescued. But was this a drone strike as it's being reported? It doesn't add up. It doesn't really even make sense. Let me tell you why. An Apache helicopter, and I've checked with sources on this, they tell me that this thing has extremely sophisticated equipment on it. Listen to what it can do. It comes with a full package. It has a longbow radar. It has modern targeting with night vision sensors, radar frequency warning systems. It's not just like a little, you know, run-of-the-mill helicopter here. It's got a missile warning system. It's got infrared countermeasures. It can create frequency interference, right? So that it's almost impossible for a drone, missiles, of course, but a drone? This is a $10,000 drone. You know, it's nothing. Like a little cheap rocket, really. Without a guidance system. I mean, and the Apache's agile, it's mobile, it's fast enough to avoid any drone. So really, the only way that this thing can get hit by a drone is if it literally, if the pilot wasn't paying attention, oops, he didn't see it, he just crashed into it, you know? Or it was trying to examine the drone and it got too close somehow and they had an accident. And by the way, if a drone actually had a direct hit on the Apache, because it's so small, the chances the pilots would have been killed on impact. So what really happened? I don't know. It sounds fishy. Of course, there's some people out there talking already about an Israeli false flag, but I got to tell you, I checked. You know, I've looked at all the evidence. I've looked at everything that's come out. I don't see anything that suggests that in any way. But of course, it's out there. It's, you know, if you go on the internet, you're going to see reports of that everywhere. As far as I know, there's no documented reporting or confirmation of that. I can't say this, though. This type of thing will happen when you have a lot of... when you have a hot war taking place in a tight place. Look at this. That's the Strait of Hormuz, right? You got drones, you got military vessels, you got planes, you got helicopters, all of this stuff, you know, moving about in this very small, narrow passageway in all directions. And that, you know, accidents happen. Okay, so what happens next? Within the past 24 hours, the United States has responded by bombing Iran. U.S. CENTCOM, Central Command, has announced that it struck Iran's air defense systems, its radar sites, its ground control stations near the Strait of Hormuz. In fact, here, we have it for you. Here's what they officially said.
U.S. Central Command forces began launching self-defense strikes against Iran at 5 p.m. Eastern Time today at the Commander-in-Chief's direction in response to yesterday's downing of a U.S. Army Apache helicopter. The mission is a proportional response to unjustified Iranian aggression.
So that's what they're saying. Let me show you what happened when the United States decided to hit over this helicopter situation, right? First, I want to break down for you as best I can the places that where the U.S. is struck. It hit. Remember, we talked a lot about this place, Kishim Island, right? Right in here into the Persian Gulf, into the Strait of Hormuz, which is what. So they hit this area right here. Then they also hit Siddiq, right? They also hit Bandar Abbas, and they also hit this area down here, Jask, right? Which is further down if you get down into the area about like where Oman is, right? Again, all in all, 20 targets, and the attack lasted about 4 hours. Mr. Trump is calling the attacks both powerful and very strong. So then, after this, what does Iran do, right? Well, they said if they were hit, they would hit back, and that's exactly what they've done. So they've hit targets mostly in the Persian Gulf countries and others that are suddenly, once again, they're caught in the crossfire of this thing, right? Who knew? They had the U.S. put a military installation there, and now they're getting bombed because they have a U.S. military installation there. Duh. So the IRGC is said it has struck U.S. targets in Jordan, right, in Bahrain, as well as in Kuwait. It fired missiles into the Al-Azraq base in Jordan. That's a big one, by the way. It fired drones into the U.S. Fifth Fleet down here in Bahrain. That's certainly significant. And it also fired a barrage of drones into the Ali al-Salem base. That one's in Kuwait. I'm going to tell you more about the Fifth Fleet in just a minute. But what does it sound like, right? What story am I retelling here? I'm basically telling you the same things I told you on the very first day of the war. It's like the United States is bombing Iran, and Iran is bombing U.S. installations inside of these Persian Gulf countries. And Israel is now involved as well. So, look, throughout the day, we've been collecting videos of these attacks. They're coming in, you know, and you probably can find some of them as well if you look on the internet. So I'm going to take you through the videos that our team has been able to gather throughout the day. Here's the first one. Let's watch. All right, that's Iran firing the missile that targets Jordan. They're kind of showing it off. They use drones to hit most of the other installations in the Persian Gulf countries, but because Jordan is so far away, they used actual missiles against this Al-Azraq base in Jordan. It's one of about 800 military bases the United States has around the world. All right, now I got another video. This is Iran's anti-defense system at work as it tries to stop U.S. drones from hitting it throughout the course of the evening. And then look at this. This is an actual strike and a video provided by the IRGC of them stopping of their defense system, they say, stopping a U.S. drone. Okay, here's another video that I'm going to show you now. Let's flip to the Iranian missile being fired at Jordan. There it is. See that? That's a missile hitting the base in Jordan right there. And you can see it over the top. Okay, now I want to flip to something else. Now I got this video. This is a hit on the Fifth Fleet base. Remember I told you about the Fifth Fleet? Okay, see that circle right there? You could barely see it, but it's kind of like, okay, watch again, and you're going to see right there. See that puff of smoke? That's the Fifth Fleet of the United States. This is huge, by the way. Fifth Fleet is responsible for the Persian Gulf. It's responsible for the Red Sea, patrols the Arabian Sea, and much of the Indian Ocean. 20,000 personnel there, a carrier strike group, comes out to about 25 ships, including destroyers and submarines. I think we've got another video I want to show you as well. These are the Patriot interceptors now trying to stop incoming rocket fire over Bahrain, but it's this one anyway seems to miss. You can see the trail there of the rocket, and the interceptor seems to have missed it, and now it's going beyond the target. See, that's part of a Patriot interceptor that's going past the missile it tried to hit but missed. Look, it's too early to know exactly what the damage is, and as we get it, we're going to be sharing it with you. But in the end, what does this really mean, right, this re-escalation? It means that the war is back on in earnest. It means Iran meant what it said when they said, look, if you hit us, we're going to hit you again. They did it. They've said on this show they were going to do it, and they did it. It means the U.S. is reengaged. It means the Strait of Hormuz is a very dangerous place once again, where the world's oil, LNG, and fertilizer chemicals cannot pass. That means we're once again facing a worldwide economic situation that could reach disastrous proportions for people, for food, for oil. Maybe most importantly, you know what this means? It means Israel gets to continue its war in Iran and with other Arab countries like Lebanon and Syria and Iraq and Yemen. Look, let's not fool ourselves. This is what Israel wants. Israel is dead set against the ceasefire. They've been fighting Trump on the ceasefire idea. It wants the United States to continue this war with Iran. Iran says it would consider a ceasefire if, remember, Iran said, we'll talk ceasefire if Israel stops bombing Lebanon. Otherwise, the war continues. What did Israel do? Instead, on May 31st, and I think we've got the video here, there it is. On May 31st, Israel reinvaded southern Lebanon with ground troops. So you could argue that that's when this thing really re-escalated, right? Israel wanted the war to escalate. And it seems tonight, as we report this here, that's exactly what it got. The war is re-escalated. Here's Turkish President Recep Erdogan. He just came out and said the very same thing that I said. Take a listen.
The attacks by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his network of murder on Lebanon and Syria have brought the issue to a point at which it also threatens Turkey. Damascus and Beirut are two brother cities of Istanbul. Turkey's security begins not just from Hatay, but also from Aleppo, from Damascus. Now these individuals and their trigger pullers come out and purportedly make threats targeting Turkey here and there. There's no need for you to say this. We already know your intention, your purpose, and your target very well.
Damn, could you imagine if all of a sudden, on top of everything that I just told you that's happening and could happen, Turkey gets involved in this thing, on top of everything else, on top of, Iraq's involvement and Yemen's involvement, potentially Syria, and obviously Lebanon. Let me add something else that's important, by the way. Because Iran has been targeting Israel, and Israel has also been targeting Iran. In fact, just within the past 24 to 48 hours, even before the helicopter downing, Israel had launched attacks on central and western Iran. And prior to that, to be fair, Iran had fired missiles into Israel as well. Can I add one more thing? As I think about it, that's really important here, and also escalatory, the Houthis. The Houthis in Yemen. You know what they just said? They said that they're going to block all Israeli navigation into or through the Red Sea. So essentially, they would be creating another potentially, it would be like the Strait of Hormuz, but another Strait of Hormuz, right? Another Strait of Hormuz scenario. It's called the Strait of Bab el-Mandab. That's the one that is the opening to the Red Sea, right? They're saying they're going to shut that down too. Can you imagine? In fact, here's how they said it.
We declare a complete and total ban on Israeli maritime navigation in the Red Sea, and we consider all enemy movements to be legitimate military targets for our armed forces.
All right, so that's the scenario. You know, I got up this morning, I saw what was going on. I said, you know what, we got to do today. And we had a meeting, our team, and we decided we were just going to go with this because, you know, it's like we're reporting the war all over again from the very beginning. Now, let's get to the guest. Joining us now to break this down is Kevork Almasyan. He's a man whose knowledge of this war zone is only exceeded by his ability to grow a really cool beard. He founded the... I knew you'd love that. He founded the Syriana Analysis on YouTube. He himself is Syrian Armenian, by the way, which is important because he can talk to us about all the pieces of this puzzle in this horrible situation that we now find ourselves. Thank you so much for joining us. And you do have a really cool beard.
Thank you so much. It's a really great pleasure to be with you. I really like your style as well. Like the style of journalism and the way you express your opinions, I think it's very spontaneous and it's very expressive for the people to be engaging with your show as well.
Well, I think it's important to share information the way you would share it with a friend. And that's what we do. And we try to tell as many truths as we possibly can. So I have to imagine you're so close to this. When you woke up this morning, or when you saw last night, I don't know when you first saw this, that this thing was like back on. What was your reaction?
Actually, I wasn't surprised at all that the war re-escalated again in the Middle East, especially between Israel, the United States against Iran, because we have to understand the core issue of this war, and that is this is Israel's war against Iran. This is not America's war. If the Americans and the Iranians sit on the negotiation table, they will reach for a compromise in the near future. And there are lots of mutual grounds between them. They could reach to a certain deal that could protect Iran's national security and also give the Americans some of the economic privileges that they're trying to enjoy in the region, and also to restore the stability in the Persian Gulf monarchies. However, the Israeli project is completely different. Israel wants to expand in the region. Israel says that they have a greater Israel project in the region, and the only country that stands between in the face of this greater Israel project is Iran. Now that Israel is engaged in this act of hostilities against Iran, they see that they haven't reached yet to the point that Iran is weak. In the contrary, Iran has emerged from this war more powerful, enjoying more leverage, has its grip over the Strait of Hormuz, and also has shown its resilience and also its capability for a tit and tat in a long war of attrition. Therefore, from the Israeli perspective, why would you go into negotiation with the Iranians that who have emerged more powerful than they used to be before the war? It makes no sense. I'm speaking from the Zionist point of view in this case. I think the Zionists have a zero-sum game in this conflict, and they believe that eliminating the strength or the elements of strength of Iran would allow them to expand into Lebanon, into Syria, and reach to the Euphrates. Now, in order to implement this greater Israel project, Israel doesn't have the military capability, the financial and economic capability to do it by itself. Therefore, they had to infiltrate the American political landscape. They had to compromise American politicians. They had to go and bribe many of the politicians, especially in the military industrial complex, in the Congress, in the CIA, in the NSA, in order to persuade them to go to this war. Mm-hmm. Before, just days before this war, the head of the Mossad met with President Donald Trump and persuaded him that this will be a few days' war. A strong strikes against the military capabilities of Iran, and then some psychological operations to urge the people to rise against the Tehran government. And when that failed, they have went into war of attrition. Now, the timeline went from few days into few weeks into few months until the end of the Donald Trump term. And this is what the Israelis and the Zionists are trying to change the narrative now. And I have to explain this, Rick, because I believe that Israel wants to become an empire in the region, an independent empire, sovereign from the American military and economic capabilities. Yeah. And in order to do that, they have to have an access to the energy markets inside Iran. And they have to have their grip over the Strait of Hormuz. They have to have their grip over Bab el-Mandeb. They have to have their grip over Morocco, for example, because there is very important strait there. And when you have an access to the Red Sea, to the Strait of Hormuz, to the Mediterranean, and an access to the energy fields inside Iran, then you will emerge as an independent sovereign empire in the region, and you don't need militarily to occupy the region, but rather to impose your influence and leverage on the rest of the countries, knowing that most of these Persian Gulf monarchies are basically weak, and they cannot even use the military hardware they have bought from the Americans. So they will replace the American protection with Israeli protection in this case. So you will see a great expansion of Israel in the region if Israel emerges victorious from this. And that's why this is a zero-sum game, and they don't want to reach to a deal with the Iranians.
Wow. So what you just said is fascinating to me. I've never heard anybody put it quite this way. What Israel is trying to do is literally control the energy flows in all of those three locations where oil goes in and out of. And if they could control that, they could literally be the most important regional power in the area. Now, the question is, Do you think for one damn cotton picking minute, as we say in the United States, that the Chinese and the Russians are going to allow, or even the Indians for that matter, or other countries are going to allow that to happen? If you're saying it, they know it as well. They're not stupid.
They're not, of course, stupid. However, the Israelis, for example, they have very good relationship with the Indians. And if we see that how the Israelis are trying to open new trade routes, for example, maritime trade routes, right?
Yeah.
From India to the Persian Gulf into Syria, for example, and then to Albania or to Greece. And that is why nowadays we have Jared Kushner buying a big island in Albania in a very strategic location, because what they're trying to do is to have an enormous expansion of these geographical, trade routes, which exist in this geographical location, in order to open trade routes and energy routes from the Persian Gulf into Europe. And if they open these trade routes and also gas pipelines between the Persian Gulf to Europe, and this is passing through an Israeli-dominated region, then Israel will not only have a leverage over the Middle East, but also over Europe. And I think that Israel is playing a very high-stake game in this, and this will lead into one of the two options. There is no middle ground any longer in this conflict, in my opinion, and I hope that I'm wrong in this. I think that Israel will use the American military capabilities, will suck the American economy dry in order to reach its destination in this, and that is... what people call now.
Well, hold on. Something just happened that goes right to what you just said. And this is fascinating. I'm glad you went there, because let me tell you what just happened. The new inflation numbers just came out in the United States. As you probably know, if you've been following this, I think back in April, it was, March was 3.3%. April went up to 3.8%. I just got the May numbers a little while ago. You know what they are? 4.2%. That means the United States is now dealing with a new level of inflation that they haven't seen in something like 5-6 years. And it's not just because it got one bad. You could always have one bad month. No, it's going up like a rocket, just like the rockets that Iran is firing right now at Israel, as a matter of fact. This is a problem. Donald Trump is not a stupid man. He knows that this is dynamite for his opposition. And it's bad for the midterms, it's bad for his presidency, it's bad for his legacy. At some point, he may have to pay the piper, and he may have to give Mr. Netanyahu a call and said, you want to keep fighting? You're on your own. We can't do this for you. What do you think? And if that happens, can Israel sustain the fight without the United States?
Well, sir, unless the Israelis have material to compromise Donald Trump as well. And this is a serious issue. I think we have to discuss it seriously, because the Israelis have been compromising American politicians for decades, and this is an empirical fact. We are not talking about conspiracy theories. And Donald Trump has a wild past. And I do believe that the Israelis may have a material on him in order to persuade him and blackmail him to continue this this war. Additionally, on a personal and on a family level, Donald Trump is gaining hundreds of millions from this conflict, including investments, for example, in Albania nowadays. This is a $5.4 billion investment in Albania, which will generate enormous money. Now, there is also another very important factor. I live in Europe. The inflation is also skyrocketing here. The prices are skyrocketing every day. The fuel and gas is like, the people do not want to see what's the price nowadays when we want to fill our vehicles.
Yeah.
However, do they really care about the people? This is the real question. Nowadays, they see that this pain is a collateral damage for the sake of a strategic victory in the region. And after the strategic victory, they could recalibrate the economies. This is what they believe nowadays. And additionally, for example, in Germany, the factories have been sacking thousands and thousands of employees every day, from the car companies, from the manufacturers, from the energy sector here in Germany. Have you seen the German people going to the street and demonstrating against their government? Only 2 days ago, a few thousand people went to the street and protested against the government, which means that the people haven't felt yet that this is truly harmful for their well-being and their welfare, and we are losing the welfare here due to these engagements in military conflicts such as in Ukraine and such as in Israel and we are sending billions of dollars from our taxpayer money, including the people who are not German. I'm also paying taxes that goes to Ukraine, that goes to Israel, and nobody asks the people if they want to send the money there. Therefore, in my opinion, the governments here, they are completely detached from the people. They have their own echo chambers. They have made their own bubbles. They only interact with each other, and they think about these strategic issues, one of which is geopolitics, and the other one is the geoeconomic. If they are if they emerge from this successfully, we know that this will reflect positively on Europe. This will reflect positively on the United States and also on Israel. So the bets and the stakes are very high for them. And they see the U.S. empire is in decay. And they're trying to either reverse it or to slow down the decay of the Americans through this war against Iran, because Iran is such an important and rich country. And it has also, the Eurasia has three legs. It's Russia, it's China, and it's Iran. And if you eliminate Iran, then the entire Eurasian economic integration will fail in the near future. So they're trying to eliminate the competitor in this case in order for them to have an exclusive right in the energy markets of the region, and hence eliminate the Russian and the Chinese reach to the markets of the region.
It's amazing, though, to think of why they, biting your nose to spite off your face, I think the expression is. Why would they do that to their own people? The EU, for example, goes around giving money to countries that they want to either join the EU. Look what they just did in Hungary. They helped to put a guy in Hungary, seems like a decent person, but the guy has now taken money for the EU to pay for the immigrants that he's going to have in his country. The immigrants are simply there because of the wars that the EU and NATO together start in other places. It's like, Syrians don't want to, you're Syrian, you know, Syrians don't want to live outside of Syria. If you had your druthers, you would have stayed in Syria, in a wonderful, stable, great, beautiful country. Just like my parents would have stayed in Cuba, and Guatemalans would have stayed in Guatemala, and Libyans would have stayed in Libya. But the EU and NATO, they go in with the United States, they destroy countries, and then they pay off governments to accept money as kind of a bribe to say, here, so you can help pay for these immigrants. Meanwhile, the people in those countries get pissed off and say, why do we have all these new immigrants in our country? We didn't ask for this, right? It's like a catch-22.
Yes, because the soft power of the EU and the United States is so enormous, and this is something that they excel, unlike the Russians and the Chinese. The Russians and the Chinese have not invested in soft power as much as the imperialist powers in the West, for example. I would give you an example of Armenia. How much the situation changed in Armenia in 15 years? It is a stark difference of how the people thought and what the people thought in the past, the public opinion, the political affiliations, and who they voted in only 15 years. And this started thanks to the EU, the Soros, the American, USAID, NED, and all these organizations investing hundreds of millions of dollars in a tiny country of 3 million people in order to compromise the political and media landscape in the country. And they succeeded it. They have established like tens of media outlets, NGOs, and public opinion leaders, social media influencers, name it. And these people are receiving funding from the EU, which means they have now an invested interest in promoting the EU talking points, because their salaries are coming from the EU. And they do reflection and projection, all these things that they do on Russia. And they say the opposition is supported by Russia. And the opposition has a Russian passport, which is untrue. And they detained tens of opposition figures in Armenia. They have corrupted the political landscape. They have bought the politicians. And now we have someone like Pashinyan, basically not only giving up on Nagorno-Karabakh, which was the strategic debt of the Armenian nation, but rather he leased southern Armenia for 99 years for Trump. And this is called the Trump Corridor now. And we have to understand the gravity of the matter. This corridor is going to be controlled by American contractors and Israeli contractors on the northern borders of Iran. and in the Southern Caucasus, which is the backyard of Russia as well, this will provoke two important powers against Armenia. This is geopolitical suicide, because this corridor is not about trade routes. It is about to give Turkey, which is a NATO member, the power of projection into Azerbaijan, into the Caspian Sea, into the Turkic countries, and NATO will have an access, an overland access into the Central Asian countries, which means they will have the capability to destabilize the casus belli of Russia. So we need to expect conflicts emerging in Turkmenistan, in Kazakhstan, and Tajikistan, in these countries in the near future, due to this corridor, unless the Russians and the Iranians change the equation, because the Iranians are saying, if this corridor is opened, we're going to destroy it. We're going to invade this corridor, because this is for them a life or death situation. The Israelis are present now on the northern borders of Iran, in addition to Nagorno-Karabakh, where I will give you an information, Rick. The Israelis, when Azerbaijan occupied Nagorno-Karabakh, they established, you can Google this yourself.
I'm looking.
smart villages in the southern part of Nagorno-Karabakh, which is now occupied and captured by Azerbaijan. They're building so-called smart villages, and Israeli ministers are coming and opening the ceremony of these smart villages. And the helicopter of Ibrahim Raisi fell 200 kilometers away from one of these smart villages inside the Iranian territories. So the Israelis, in my opinion, are waging psychological, technological, and also intelligence operations inside Iran through Azerbaijan. And this week, the CNN acknowledged that Israel sent troops to Azerbaijan during this war against Iran. So Azerbaijan is also on board in this. Therefore, the EU is supporting Pashinyan to become allies and partners with Azerbaijan, but Azerbaijan and Turkey will swallow Armenia sooner or later if they join this type of alliance with them. It is sandwiched between two hostile countries, and demographically and business-wise, they will just swallow Armenia, and Armenia will become another wilayet for Turkey. And sooner or later, Armenians will start speaking Turkish. And this is something that I'm not saying it to fearmonger anyone. This is just a circle of history, and it will happen under Pashinyan.
What you just described sounds to me exactly like what NATO and Washington did in Ukraine. They went in, they started a coup, they made a country that was neutral be unneutralized. They made sure that it was anti-Russia, not just, you know, that it could deal with Russia. It punished the people in their country who were beholden to Russia and said, no, you can't worship in Russian, you can't speak the Russian language. And eventually Russia said, well, I'm sorry, but we're just not going to allow this, nor are we going to allow you to take Sevastopol or the rest of Crimea, and we're just going to have to go in. To the rest of the world, this looked like some crazy arbitrary decision that this crazy man, Vladimir Putin, took one day. In actuality, this war started in 2014, and the Russians would say, you provoked us. That's what you just described that's happening right now in Armenia. So my question is, do you see Armenia ending up the same as Ukraine?
I mean, Armenia is heading steadily, slowly but surely, to this direction. And I'm asking only one question to the Armenian leadership nowadays. Name me one objective, reasonable reason why should Armenia become an anti-Russian or anti-Iranian satellite state. There is no single reason, logically, geographically, geopolitically, economically, not a single reason for Armenia to become hostile to these important players. Armenia should be, as it was before 2018 color revolution, a state that is diversifying its relationship between the East and the West. Exactly.
Neutral.
I mean, the former president, for example, of Armenia, before he was ousted through this color revolution, he wanted an association agreement with the EU, and at the same time he was in another trade association agreements with Russia. So he was diversifying his relationship, and nobody was mad and upset at Armenia back in the day until Pashinyan came. And this is just a pattern. After the fall of the Soviet Union, we have seen in many countries these color revolutions, and it leads into one place. First, destroy the national identity, destroy the church, like Pashinyan is doing nowadays, and then give up on your sovereignty and become a puppet government for the West and for NATO, and then become a hostile ground for an important country like Russia and Iran. And this will provoke a geopolitical conflict in the region. And Armenia is a very small country compared to Ukraine. And it would be eliminated in a matter of hours. We're not talking about a big geography like Ukraine. We're not talking about a big military power like in Ukraine. We're talking about a small 3 million populated country. So that's why I called it a geopolitical suicide. There has to be sanity in the Armenian politics, and they have to understand that this path is definitely leading them to another Ukraine dilemma. And remember, once I say this, they will come and say, this is a Kremlin talking point. You were talking on a Russian TV and this and that. I'm literally saying we need to be neutral and we have to diversify our relationship between the East and the West. There is no Kremlin talking point in this. I'm just caring about my Armenian nation. I have lost my Syria, and I don't want to lose another my fatherland, basically Armenia, to stupid geopolitical calculations. And I think this is fair to say.
Yeah, I'm looking at the map here. It's fascinating. As you were talking about this, I went to it, and I'm looking at the map, and you're right. Armenia sits like right there in the middle between huge border with Turkey, huge border with Iran, as big a border with both Georgia and Azerbaijan. It doesn't have a border with Russia. But, you know, damn, I haven't asked anybody here in Russia, but I imagine tomorrow if I would go over and knock on the door of Mr. Lavrov or the foreign ministry and ask them, how concerned are you about this? They would tell me, we're not going to go on the record, Rick, but you know what? We're very concerned. And I don't know what they would do, but I imagine if they had to, they would likely join forces with Iran to make sure that Armenia remains a neutral country. I would imagine that's what they would say, right? I mean, doesn't that make sense?
I think what Russia could do in this case is, of course, look, in the past, we had leaders in Armenia who have had a reputation of being corrupted leaders. Whether this is true or not, it's completely irrelevant. This is what the Pashinyan government has indoctrinated and brainwashed the Armenian people. Whether you like it or not, this is what they believe. Therefore, for example, someone like Robert Kocharyan or others who were in the past in positions of power, those people cannot become an alternative. There has to be a new alternative in Armenia coming from the grassroots, coming from the younger generation who would persuade and also convince the people that they are an alternative for the Armenian people rather than Pashinyan. But if you put the past leaders as oppositionists to Pashinyan, then the Pashinyan government will weaponize this and say, look, all these corrupt leaders, they want to become the leader of Armenia again, so you better vote for me, because the corrupt leaders of the past, they will suck the economy dry. Meanwhile, Armenia is selling its national economy to the EU corporations. They're selling their natural resources to the EU corporations. And most importantly, they're going to buy the gas from Azerbaijan. Can you imagine that Armenia would stop importing gas from Russia and then importing from Azerbaijan?
And paying twice as much for it.
Azerbaijani leader Aliyev says Armenia as a whole is Western Azerbaijan. He says it publicly on tape. So you will buy a gas from Aliyev and become dependent on Aliyev, and then allow him to have more leverage over the political class in Armenia, because all these politicians are corrupted, and they will try to make deals with these gas companies in order to enrich themselves. So they will become more pro-Azerbaijani and more pro-Turkish in this case.
What happens? You know what? You're right, and we see a lot of this. And what you just described, and you describe it so well, by the way, how the EU, how Washington, how the CIA, how MI6, all of these organizations, Mossad, go into these countries and fiendishly, secretly influence the political direction of these countries. And they do it over and over and over again. And by the way, last time I checked, I don't understand how in the hell Armenia can be part of the NATO alliance, which is North Atlantic. Is Armenia any... Have you looked at... I'm looking at a map right now. Armenia is nowhere near the Atlantic, by the way. So, I mean...
They will never become a NATO member. They will never become an EU member. This is why Pashinyan said that we want to apply for an EU and we will increase the standards of our state according to the standards of the EU. Even if we don't join the EU in the future, at least we will become like EU. What they're trying to do is basically to liberalize the visa between Armenia and the EU. And this will give enormous EU influence and leverage over the Armenian people. Because let's remember, this soft power is very attractive. The people would like to go to the EU countries. The people would like to go and study in the EU countries. The people would like to do their vacation in the EU countries. So if you liberalize the visa, then the people will continue voting for Pashinyan. And I think the intervention of these EU countries was so stark, so blatant, like only 1 month ago before the elections, all these EU leaders, including Macron, including Ursula von der Leyen, and name it, all of them were in Armenia, shaking hands with Pashinyan, endorsing him. Now imagine if there was a third or a fourth level official from Russia coming to Armenia and saying, look, I will endorse Kocharyan.
Yes.
Kocharyan would have ended in prison in a matter of hours. He would have been accused of being a Kremlin agent. So this is what is, as we say in Arabic, what is halal for them is haram for Russia, right? This is an Arabic word that I'm using nowadays. I think your audience would understand it.
Yeah, yeah.
But they can do it blatantly. And that's why we don't have in Armenia this foreign agent law. If there is a law that can detect and follow this foreign money being poured into Armenia, there will be scandal because hundreds of millions of euros are being poured by the EU countries into these small countries that are all under the table, and we don't know who and how this money is arriving in Armenia.
It's a shame that that happens, and it's so unfair, and it's so hidden, and nobody in the Western media will ever report something like this or even give it a mention. What do you think happens, by the way? Let's suppose this war continues the way it's going, the way you were describing it a little while ago, where Iran just seems to be, well, just doing very well. I mean, they're holding their own. They're standing up to the attacks. They're hitting Israel hard. The United States is stuck. There is no way that they can get themselves out of this thing right now without causing a political, geopolitical, domestic disaster for Mr. Trump, not to mention a huge economic fallout. So if Iran is victorious, it would be the first time in my lifetime. Yeah, you could say the United States didn't win in Iraq, it didn't win in Afghanistan. But it would be the first time where this is almost like Jimmy Carter-esque. It's like a disaster. It's a military disaster. It's like you went in saying you were going to do something in 3 days, and actually you left out, you left with a loss. That's what this looks like it could be. What will be the effect of this geopolitically in places like Armenia and around the world? How will they see the West now?
Actually, I think the wars against Iraq and Afghanistan aimed at first destroying the states and then prolonging the war as long as possible. It was a forever war. It was the military-industrial complex recycling and laundering money through the military deals and also the energy deals in these countries. So they didn't want to have a decisive victory in Iraq or in Afghanistan, and then they withdrew. But in Iran, they wanted to topple the government and urge the people to rise against the government in a matter of days. They wanted a decisive victory against Iran. They wanted regime change. Yeah. They wanted to balkanize Iran.
Yeah.
They wanted to turn it into mini states, and they have failed. And this is a strategic failure for the Americans and for the Israelis, in my opinion. In the near future, I don't see that there would be a deal between the Americans and the Iranians. I don't see that a deal would be reached that could address all the strategic files in the region. I think that this war will prolong until November, till there are elections inside the United States, and the next administration may change course. I don't have much hope because the uniparty system is also very questionable inside the United States. But I'm hopeful that the change may come from inside the MAGA base, and we can see the shift inside the MAGA base from the people who are supporting Donald Trump and shifting now their positions and saying that this is not what we voted for. And therefore, I see a split inside the MAGA base, and there could be a real anti-war candidate coming from the MAGA base. And this is very dangerous for Israel, and they're following this situation that the biggest danger for them is not from the left. in the United States. The biggest danger comes if the right turns against Israel, because their selling point inside the United States is that our alliance and with you is not only based on geopolitics, this is a moral and religious duty. So if the right turns its back, the conservative Christian movement against Israel, I think this would be an existential threat for Israel. And Israel knows the public opinion is shifting and sees that this is a narrow window of opportunity for them to achieve a decisive strategic victory against Iran. And that's why they want to continue this war, because if the situation changes inside the United States, if there is a true, let's say, a candidate inside the American political landscape who would say enough is enough, and we will care about our American people, we will no longer go to forever wars, then the Israelis will be on themselves in the Middle East. And that's why they want to have an access to these trade and energy routes before the public opinion changes inside the United States and before the decay of the American empire. This is very important for them, and they see it as a zero-sum game.
And that's why they spent $34 million to take down Thomas Massey, but they may have made him more popular, and they may have made him that guy you just mentioned who might be the next candidate from the MAGA movement, from the right, who runs for president of the United States and very well could win with the backing of Tucker Carlson, with the backing of Candace Owens, and with the backing of so many others who are extremely vocal and becoming anti-Israel and anti-forever wars in the United States.
Yes.
What a great conversation I had with you. My God, you're fantastic. I really enjoy what you have to say. It seems like you're very cogent. You're very disciplined. You've thought through a lot of these things and obviously talk about them. If people want to watch your podcast, direct them, please.
Thank you so much. I'm doing daily live streams between Monday to Friday on Syriana Analysis. I created it just to cover the Syrian war, and now we are covering broader geopolitical conflicts like Iran, like Ukraine, and the multipolarity and unipolarity. We do regular shows and interviews and talks with geopolitical experts on my show.
You're fantastic. I'm so glad you're there, and I'm so glad you were gracious enough to give us so much of your time. Kevork, thanks so much. We appreciate it, my friend. I'll see you again soon.
Thank you so much, sir.
All right, let's get to the mailbag if we possibly can. War is over, says beyond the pure moral and legal point. No one in government cares about the government. It's a big money grab. Yeah, that one came from Mount South. Also, Edgar Fleetwood comments and says, as a Canadian, it's very disturbing to see how extremely biased our media reports are about Ukraine and Russia and Israel. Thank goodness for people like you for both, for helping us to see the other side. He was referring, by the way, to my interview with Scott Ritter, which aired just the other day while I was in Spieth. Tuma Holdings says, a really good show, Rick Sanchez. I can't wait for the day you get real Scott Ritter, Colonel Doug McGregor, Colonel Dan Davis on your show all at once. That would be pretty cool, because I admire all of them for what they have to say, though I don't always agree with what they have to say. C-Mac comments, I like what Rick and Scott have to say on some topics, but you're allowed on RT because you are critical of the U.S. empire. And he says, as you should be. Well, which is it, by the way? Look, I create this show with what I think every day. I talk about it with our staff. We're completely independent, and there's nobody in the Russian government who tells us what to say or what to do. Just thought you'd know. And what we generally cover are geopolitics. So, but listen, you're entitled to your opinion, and thank you for sharing it. Emuis says, it is deeply unfortunate that we are constantly presented with false dichotomies. In this case, between the moribund liberal status quo and the overtly sleazy and spiritually repulsive Andrew Tate, what forces are keeping us locked into these fake choices? Fair comment. Cicero says, Cicero, wow. Every time I listen to Andrew, he's referring to Andrew Tate, he never ceases to amaze me. What a great statesman he would be. I found him interesting. I also told him that I didn't agree with his lifestyle and that I found many of the things that he said and done offensive and mean. But that doesn't mean that I have a right to determine his lifestyle, nor does it mean that we don't have a right to listen to what he has to say. That's how we do things here on The Sanchez Effect. That's it for us. You can find me, by the way, on X or on Spotify or on YouTube or on BitChute. And feel free to leave your thoughts All the feedback is appreciated, by the way, good or bad, as you can see. Thank you for welcoming us into your homes, and we'll see you again next time.